Welcome to Ever Beyond, 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 on Wolf Spirit Radio, Ever Beyond Radio, and Tir na Sao in Ireland. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, beyond. Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Car or something, I think, and then there's a
Good afternoon. Sorry to cut you off there, Ken. Good afternoon. This is Ever Beyond on Ever Beyond Radio and Wolf Spirit Radio. And indeed, it seems to be going on Haggy Shack and oldones.com and, you know, everybody else. Oh, yes, Tir na Sao. Let's bring in Tir na Sao. And well, and welcome to Tir na Sao on Ever Beyond His Way as well. Today, well, last week my guests were Brett Shepherd, and we had some interesting conversations about the moon, the Kin Moon, and he mentioned his source of photographs, the man with the archive, the man who conveniently disobeyed. Bless your heart. Dr. Mr. Ken Johnston. Good afternoon. Is this Johnston or Johnston? It is Johnston.
The T, Johnston, the Scottishman.
Aye, Manny. Aye. Well, I'm here in northern Scotland here. In northeast Scotland.
Excellent.
So, good afternoon. Well, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience? I gave them, you know, I gave the nutshell there. Do you want to kind of tell that story? Because it's, you know, a lot of people here have been connected in some way with the military-industrial complex. A lot of people are suffering from PTSD and other symptoms of the military-industrial complex. We're pretty kind of up to speed on various space programs, let's put it that way, all the other things that people get up to in the deep dark world of the MI the military industrial all the other things that they do. So how did you get into NASA? That's the first one.
Okay. Just to give a real quick thumbnail on it, the best part would be, you know, get a copy of the autobiography, because that goes on for hours. Anyway, now my dad was a pilot during World War II, and when he lost his life in a bomber, the only pictures I had of my dad was in uniform and as a pilot, and I figured, you know, I was going to grow up, I wanted to become a pilot too. Well, as life goes on, I went through Military Academy, the Oklahoma Military Academy, which was considered the West Point of the Southwest, where you got a regular commission. After leaving there, I wound up, this is kind of dumb part, because we do crazy things when we're young and we think we're brilliant, but sometimes they work out okay. I was a captain in advanced ROTC at the college, and during the summer, I was at Oklahoma City University, and my best friend, who was also a captain at the academy, comes into the dorm at night. He says, "Ken, I've joined the Marines." And I said, "Like hell you have." I went down the next day, and we went from captains to Marine Corps buck privates in San Diego, California. And after we came, I came up series honor man, the highest ranking in the whole battalion, so which is kind of cool. And then we left, went to avionics electronic training at Memphis, Tennessee, both of us. And Jack stayed at El Toro in California. I went on to Pensacola in the officer MARCAD program to become a pilot. That's where I learned to fly. And after I completed my tour of duty with the Marine Corps, I got out and went back to Norman, where my mother lived, in Norman, Oklahoma University. The big OU fellows might like the football team there. Used to be great. And then on down to Houston, where my brother, Dr. A.R. Johnston, was a worked for the government. He was a GS-12 rating, made pretty good money. He was one of the designers of the largest vacuum chamber in the world and at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, the Lunar Sample Processing Lab. He told me to come on down to Houston. This was 1966, and NASA was just beefing up. All of the contractors were going with contractors and hiring people left and right. Anyone that had the talent that could do a job, they were being hired, and I was fortunate. I went to about five of the top aerospace companies, Grumman, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, everyone that was around the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Back then it was called MSC, Manned Spacecraft Center. Anyway, I applied for jobs, and 2 days later I had offers from all five of them, and I chose to go with Grumman, which built the lunar module, and I became one of the first four civilian astronaut consultant pilots, and our job was to test the lunar module in the vacuum chambers and be sure that it functioned properly before the astronauts took it into space, and also to assist in the training of the regular NASA astronauts. So that's what got me there. Then once we landed on the moon, Apollo 11, the word came down that I thought I had an extended job going into the next phase of the Apollo portion, which was putting in a telescope on the bottom of the lunar module and connect it to Skylab, which was our first space station. But then the government canceled that and said, it's no longer going to be research and development, R&D, and going in space. It will be routine flights to the moon. And so we got laid off. I went over to the Lunar Receiving Laboratory and became the director of the Data and Photo Control Department. But kind of interesting that Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Mike Collins of Apollo 11 were on their way back to the Earth whenever I was hired to go over to the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. So I caught them in quarantine. The first two flights, we had to quarantine the astronauts to be sure that they didn't bring back any pathogens from the moon. So in my position as the director of data and photo control for all the lunar samples and processing, I wound up keeping all of the photographs and film strips, everything that was done on each mission, so that the contributing scientists from around the world would be able to get photographs from space as to the area on the moon where their sample comes from, as well as those pictures taken by the astronauts on the lunar surface. And I had like five sets of those in filing cabinets, so that if they walked in, I could provide them with what they need. I got letters of commendation for that. There were some people that tried to say, you didn't do that, you weren't there. Well, I have the letters from NASA giving me congratulations and thanking me for the job I did. And Brown & Root gave me a $1,000 bonus for fixing the systems up and getting everything ready for them. So it's fun. Other people make accusations. I just pull out documents and prove things. That's the way it goes. So anyway, that's how I wound up. Whenever I would get pictures for the scientist, I would always get an extra one for myself and put it in Ken Johnston's private little archive, so to speak. Since I was the director, I could do that. And ultimately, whenever the Apollo was over, another little part to throw in there, once we finished going to the moon and we started into the space shuttle era, I was asked to apply for the regular astronaut position. And I got letters of recommendation from Neil Armstrong, Jack Schweikert, Jim Irwin, and letters of... I've got signatures signed in my spacecraft pilot's logbook from 79 different astronauts that I worked with over the period of years. So, yep, I was there for a long time and made a positive contribution. And now that I've run into people that have looked at my archive that I didn't really look at that much because of raising a family, three kids, marrying a woman with two daughters, and now we have 18 grandchildren. 18 grandchildren, and I have two great-grandchildren, and I'm expecting a third great-grandchild in March. So I've kind of made a dent in society somewhere. Anyway, that's how I wound up in the position where I was and had access and kept all of the pictures and in the film that now are becoming very interesting because I have experts like Brett Shepard and Steve Troy that have looked at the pictures and they've discovered anomalies that I never looked at. I was just looking at things as an engineer and a pilot and wasn't looking at what was down on the ground when they're in orbit. And I am amazed at the things that they're discovering. And That's what we're doing now, is getting the books and things out and the pictures and things out so that the world can have a look and they can be the judge of what really is on the moon.
The moon. The moon. We're on the moon. Yeah, so fascinating.
Actually, it was Richard C. Hoagland that kind of tagged me with the moniker of Ken's Moon.
Ken's Moon. So
I guess that's kind of, we decided that would be the cover part of each one of the five books that we're putting out. Two of them are already out. If you go to KenJohnstonMedia.com, you can track and follow all the books and what's going on. And actually, right now, we have a free thing. You might even like this. If you copy it down, it's Ken Johnston's Lunar Anomalies, a report. And it's like 16 pages, and it's some of the best anomalies that we've come across so far. That it's free. If people want to go there to KenJohnstonMedia.com, they can see what we're talking about. And I think they'll enjoy it. And that'll be free. If they want to make a contribution to help and get it out to the world, we'll take that too.
Yes. Hi, JP.
Hey, Brett. How you doing, mate?
I'm doing good. I spent the last couple of days talking to another NASA employee, and it seems to me that there was a contingent to sanitize images and whatnot for the public viewing.
Yes.
And I think the main thing or the main point currently, it is for them to come clean with those objectives. They were painting out stars and whatever else so that it wouldn't confuse the public or they wouldn't have to answer questions about them.
Mm-hmm.
And now, just for the simple fact that they have hired or volunteers that work there that are debunkers, these people that say that there's no such thing as aliens and there's no such thing as UFOs, are actually posing the question in people's minds just for the simple fact that they're trying to debunk it. Now, the main objective, I think, is to regain faith in our space agencies and so that they could come clean themselves, because I would rather them do that publicly than for us to discover these things and get that out to the public that way. It'll restore some faith in the space agency, and that's what I wanted to say about that. There's also the Brookings Institute reports that they kind of go on that, you know, pretty much state that they don't want to show the public anything that they discover that could be construed as extraterrestrial life or alien life. And the reason for that is to maintain a continuity in society, and so that they feel that there needs to be continuity. They don't want to create fear in the public, and also for national security reasons. You know, so I just wanted to say that, you know, that's one of the reasons.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that, the Brookings Institute, which is the MIT back in the, before Apollo started, and they issued the report saying that if evidence of the existence of extraterrestrial life, either in the past or present, either on the moon, the Earth, or on Mars, should not be made public. So NASA had been following that directive, and of course directive from the president at the time, on down till now, and that in itself is justification for them. And if you go back and you look at the H.G. Wells and the War of the World, and some of the people committed suicide because they thought we were under attack by extraterrestrials. And now people have matured, society has grown to the point, whereas, as Brett says, it's time to come clean, and we can clear the slate so that nobody gets a bad smudge in the face for what has been done in the past, because it was all done with good intentions. So hopefully what we are doing, releasing my archive and the information, will help.
Yes, eventually we have to tell the world that there's no such thing as Santa Claus.
Yeah, there's a little quote from one of the astronauts, isn't there? But here's the thing. Here's the thing. And I really want to address this right now. There has been a lot of damage going on. because there's been a psyop going on about the flat Earth. We it's a psyop, and it's deliberately discrediting NASA. It's going straight for, oh, NASA is lying. This is what they're lying about.
Yes, it goes hand in hand with the we didn't go to the moon people.
Yes, but here's the thing. It's, in a way, it's a kind of sideways attack at NASA. And I'm wondering where that also might be coming from.
Well, basically is a fundamentalist idea that comes from various religions. And it's usually religious people that are coming and saying that because they do not want any proof of aliens or extraterrestrials because they're basically, you know, it goes against what they believe.
I had a member of my family laugh at the pictures and says, I said, well, you know, what about the dinosaur fossils and things like that? She said, no, the Earth is only 6,000 years old. And I said, well, now, wait a minute. What about all of the archaeology and geology and stuff that proves it? She said, oh, you know, God created that way and put those things in around so we could find dinosaurs and things like that. It was just to give us something to think about. And I'm thinking, wow. And this was in my own family.
That's a really paranoid God, isn't it?
It really is. What I love is if the Earth is flat, does that mean that the moon is flat and the sun is flat? And the rest of the solar system is flat.
Yeah, everything rotates. It's also geocentric.
Yeah, it's sort of ridiculous. The smallest part of the whole, you know, so if you look at the construction of atoms or even energy, it is toroidal, it is round. You know, so it's really quite impossible for there to be a natural flat Earth.
I wrote something and on the Facebook when someone was challenging me, and I said it's a sad thing that people will not accept reality, and the worst part about it is that they are reproducing, and that's scary.
Yeah, that's right. Darwin Awards. It's been something that is it's burst out of Facebook. It's burst out of the internet because I'm getting my neighbor saying to me, hey, do you know why my friends are saying that there's a flat Earth? And I'm going like, oh my God, you know, it's left the internet and is now coming into the pubs and the people are talking about it. There may be a really big thing about this.
How can it possibly be a big thing when it's a very, very, very tiny small people who want to use a very tiny small portion of their brain that are going to go into it. And it's mostly for attention. It's a psychological thing.
Yes, and it goes along with the old, like you said, a psyop. It's a loyalty test for religion. Because soon after that, you don't have to talk to them very long before they say, well, do you believe in God or whatever? So they start going into that trip. And it seems to be some kind of agenda to corral sheep or whatever into a certain belief mindset.
I tell you, it gives me such a convoluted mind. I get this tiny little pain right in the middle of my head. Do you get that? I mean, I'm looking at these videos.
I get that every time I'm actually literally lied to my face.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You see, and it's people say, oh, give it up. You know, I've gone through the whole thing. I've gone through all the arguments, and I'm like, oh, yeah. what was his name? I can't remember. Aristosthenes or something did it like 3,000.
Galileo
did it. But, you know, Eratosthenes, I think his name was, he stuck a stick in Athens. No. Yeah, Athens.
Yes, that was...
And he stuck a stick in Giza.
When he and Hypatia were proving that the circular, the solar system, that we actually revolve around the sun and not the opposite.
That's right. They gave up their life
for that. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were in prison, they were killed, you know.
Yeah, so I totally agree. Flat Earth is an idiot trap. And if anybody is promoting it on your friend site, you know, just mark them, put them in a group. put them together. Here you go. Go and enjoy. Go and shout and swear at each other. Meanwhile, back on the moon.
Okay.
All right.
Just a side thing here, JP, is that interesting enough is that the Pope just recently came out and said that we would probably, that there is bound to be intelligent life somewhere else in the universe. That's a big step from the flat Earth.
Certainly. However, he is not, he has not actually rescinded the declaration, whatever it was called, the papal bull, of Pope Gregory that says, I own all this stuff, and the Earth is flat, and time is this. And yeah. I'm not, you know, we use his, look, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but why have we got such a crazy convoluted calendar that has 28 days, 31 days, 30 days? Nobody has ever answered me this. It doesn't really work. It's a head nip, as we say in Scotland. It's a boondoggle, I think, as you call it there. It's designed to make you feel subservient to those who know the time.
Yeah, they should go by the old moon calendar, you know?
That's right. It's much easier because you can see what phase of the moon it is without having to know what date it is. You know, you don't need a calendar to know what week it is.
Yeah, the moon shows you both, and it also shows you that the Earth is round.
Exactly.
I like the way that Buzz Aldrin handled someone with equally brilliant mind, accusing him of lying that he never went to the moon. He just turned around and decked him.
that's the final resolution that
aggravated him. He said, swear on the Bible and you didn't go to the moon.
Right. And Buzz Aldrin just finally had all he could handle. He turned around and clubbed him. And I think he got away with it.
I have a whole bunch of people to line up for Buzz Aldrin's signature.
Yep.
Of the same mindset.
Instead of going to the moon as being our hero there, he's the hero for protecting the truth.
All right. Okay, so there's that. All right. Because, you know, the moon, to me, you know, I go on about the moon to people all the time, all right? People think I'm a loony. But
that's where the term came from.
We are, actually.
Legally are loony.
Legally loony. But here we are. You know, the moon... All right, so let's deal with another anomaly, right? The Stanley Kubrick photographs. Is there, in your collection, a set of square frame Hasselblad photographs that are one after the other completely perfect?
The majority of my, actually 99% of them, were made off of the original negatives. And because at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, the scientists needed to have the most detailed, highest resolution. We didn't have BPI back in those days.
All right, so you have closest to the original copy.
Yes. Ken absolutely has some of the most all of the originals, and they're it's well, I'll just be blunt. Stanley Kubrick did not film them.
No, and the thing about it is these pictures, when they first kind of got partially exposed in some of the books that Richard C. Hoagland put out, he had people contact him and say, well, on such and such picture we got from NASA, it looks like there might have been something here or there. And so then they would come to me and go to my archive and use it as the control, because mine, being originals, had the data there. And they would look at it and say, well, the guy's right, there's nothing there. Or, oh my God, would you look what is reflecting in the visor of the astronaut there? And that became kind of a little clue we had. If you really wanted to know what they were looking at, and you're looking at a photograph of one of the astronauts, look at the visor, look at the reflections in the visor, and you'll see what's behind the guy taking the picture, and that most likely is what you weren't supposed to see.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing to mention is the reflection of the visor is whatever's out in open space, because the LEM, or the lunar module, was behind them in both of those visor images.
Okay, so what is in the original photographs in the visor?
In the original, there's all kinds of crap flying around in the lunar sky.
Now, Brett says that, and I have to admit that I never looked at the pictures that I had from that standpoint.
This is like the thing, you weren't expecting them to be there.
Right.
So you weren't looking so closely at the quality of the content of the photograph. You probably, you know, if I'm, for instance, listening to some audio, I'm listening to the quality of the audio if there's noise and pops and crackles on it, and you'll be looking at the quality of the photograph, won't you?
Well, no, that I was primarily looking at the quality of the pictures of the spacecraft, the astronauts and what they were doing, and the experiment packages they were putting on the surface, because I was the chief test director of the TM-5, which is the training module 5, a descent stage, because once they landed on the moon and they came out on the lunar surface, they had to go around to the side of the lunar descent stage door to be able to pull out the equipment that they're going to use to explore on the moon, to set up, to see if there was any moonquakes, the atmosphere, if any, and even set up cameras that took pictures of them. That's one of the things some of the people say. Well, look at that. They showed a picture of the moon, of the lunar module lifting off of the surface of the moon. Who was out there taking the picture? Well, okay, here's the real answer. They set up the tripod, and the camera was sitting there being controlled at mission control by the camera operator, and you had to allow for the 3-second delay for the signal to get from the Earth to the moon. And so they had worked with it to where they knew exactly when they had the countdown for pushing the button for the ignition of the ascent stage to go back up and rendezvous with the command module. And then 3 seconds before they were to push the button and launch, the person on the Earth operating the video camera had punched in the movement to make the camera start tilting up, and it hit at the same time, and it caught beautifully, catching the lunar module lifting off the surface. People look at that, and they start saying, well, see there, it couldn't have been done. I mean, you know.
Yeah, the same.
That's always been their question.
The same camera does the panoramic images. And the other thing people would say is well, during Apollo 11, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong flipped off their plus packs or whatever and left them on the surface of the moon. And they did that because they were heavy and they wanted the lunar module to be to have much less weight, you know, so that they could lift off properly and get back to Earth.
Now, let me add to that, because I'm the old guinea pig from Grumman that actually developed, and I've got lots of pictures, if you don't see them, of me wearing the spacesuits and developing a changeover procedure by being able to switch from one life support system to another. So once we got back inside the lunar module with our portable life support system, the PLIS, on our backs, we had to then switch over to the lunar module's environmental control system. Then we had our suits were pressurized and everything else. We would disconnect the PLIS and take them off our backs, and then ready to leave, we would toss them out on the surface of the moon out the front door so that we weren't carrying those extra 100 pounds here and 100 pounds there. And that's really, you know, the people that say, oh, well, you couldn't do that. Well, you don't understand the technology and the procedures and how we worked them out so that we did do it.
So they're very highly rehearsed situations.
Very highly. And in vacuum chambers as well, which were, those who understand vacuums, it would be 10 to the minus 12 torr, which is about one molecule of air for every cubic foot. So, you know, that's not much air to breathe.
Mm-hmm. Now, the surface of the moon, you have all the telemetry there. What are the... Okay, so, you know, if you were having a remote control system situation, you know, and you were going to leave some sensors there, what kind of sensors would you leave? Would you leave, like, atmospheric humidity and oxygen levels and CO2 levels and things like that? What would be the instruments? I mean, you obviously did the work on that, of what do you call that? Remote sensing data, isn't it?
Each mission to the moon carried additional or different types of equipment with them. And mind you, this is 45 to 50 years ago. If you talk to Brett for a second, I'll run over to one of my archives and I'll pull out the layout that we set up on the moon on Apollo 11 and 12 and 14. And I can tell you what kind of equipment it was we put on the moon. So I'll talk to Brett and I'll grab them. It's nice having a good archive.
Yeah, the experiment packages that were taken up on the lunar surface were variant with each mission. You know, some of them were the same experiment because they needed more data. And he's going to tell you exactly what they were. I believe one of them was the solar...
solar array.
Solar array that they put up.
It was basically a little flag metal hanging down to collect the solar radiation.
Yes, and they also put up mirrors to reflect a laser back to Earth or to communicate with the surface that way.
I've got a big flip here.
All right. Now I can't actually display the camera on the show.
No, I meant for you.
Yeah, but I can watch it. I'll describe it for people. Okay. The blind leading the blind in the land of the deaf. Okay, go ahead. Open your screen up. I wish. Well, this is one of the things that I want to have in the future. Oh. Oh, what's that? Now, okay. I'm looking at... No, there. Hey, there.
Okay, there we go. All right, one of the things we actually used was a nuclear, if you want to call it that, generator to generate the electricity.
I've often wondered about that. I mean, all of this stuff runs on electricity that they have.
Right.
And so, you know, you're going to have to generate household mains... generally, you know, you got, or maybe, all right, so your motors maybe run 12, 24 volts. What was your voltage level? And what was the current capacity? Can you, sorry, I'm being, maybe being a little too techie, but these are the questions, you know. How did you, in heaven's name, get the kind of electrical capacity to do all the stuff that you did, taking the an object from Earth to the moon, running on batteries? I mean, I have a battery. My phone lasts half a day. What the heck? How did you do it?
The power generator, it created the energy continuously. In fact, at that, I think some of them are still running on the lunar surface. If you had asked me this question 45 years ago, I think... 28 volts sticks in my brain. I don't know why.
28, what a curious number. But anyway, okay, thank you. Like, I mean, these are like, I've looked at the moon and I've got a zillion questions. And I'm open. I'm really open. You know, because I've got some other questions about the moon itself and what you may have gleaned from it. Because there are some... There's stuff about the moon. Okay, please go ahead.
That's one of the interesting things is they, you know, NASA didn't really go all that much into some of the technical things that they invented to go to the moon.
Oh.
And it's wonderful because they had free energy back then.
Absolutely. You know, if they have a device that can generate 28 volts for 60 years, right, why aren't we driving around in these vehicles that don't pollute? And if they are polluting, why did we leave polluting things on the moon? I'm sure the neighbors would be objective.
We can't discuss that. That's a corporate question, and we can't discuss that.
Oh, there's an edge. Okay, sorry. But yes, indeed. So, and why haven't Grumman released a vehicle that we... Well, maybe they have, but we can't buy them. Yeah, so other questions that you probably can't answer due to industrial secrecy. Meanwhile...
I'll answer almost anything because it's so far in the past. You were asking other things. We had solar panel arrays that were set up in later missions. I don't know which one that one was. We also had drills so we could drill down into the lunar surface and extract core samples so we could get an idea as to what the sub-regolith was like on the lunar surface. One of the interesting things is we had to create a kind of a rake scoop so that they could be able to scoop up...
Can you turn your lens a little bit to your right? Oh, there you are. Okay, so it's... just a little
that's
bit
more.
That way. Oh, sorry, you can't see me. Hang on, let me just turn my camera on so I can point at the things. There we go. Hello. Okay, so what we're looking at is just a bit further. That's it. Perfect. Okay, so what we're looking at is a what looks like a steel comb-like affair with
a basket.
Yeah, with a basket that is like a kind of thin steel bands that are then welded together. I imagine it's still maybe titanium. And then also you have a big steel band around it that has a handle that attaches to some bayonet thing, and a hinge. And there is this the handle?
No. This is actually the core drill that would drill down into the lunar surface.
All right. Can you turn it around? Turn it 90 degrees, please. Thank you.
Well, yeah. You're going to have to go in portions.
Okay. So battery pack and handle, and drill. Okay.
Extra bits.
And you got bits that sort of, as it drills down, just add more like a oil drilling thing, yeah.
Yeah, just like if you were making a water well, yeah.
Yeah. This is the first time we've ever done any of these pictures on the live.
Well, what we're going to do, I'm the deaf leading the blind, so what I'm going to do is describe as much as I can what I'm looking at. Okay, so here is a flat surface-looking thing. That's a solar panel, a very military-looking solar panel. Big, clunky steel casing with a leveling leg, so that you can get it pointed towards the sun. Did it track?
45 and 50 years ago, it doesn't look like solar panels now.
No.
But okay, this is an interesting one because this is. On Apollo 12, they didn't have the lunar rover. They just had to pull a cart along with them, and they needed to have all of their equipment with them. And so this gives you an idea of let me get it.
All right.
There you go. All the different equipment they needed to collect the various types of samples.
Wow. A real kind of utility toolkit. And they could handle all this stuff with their spacesuit on?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And everything was built and engineered so that they could grip it easily. And you invented Velcro, didn't you?
Right.
Velcro was one of the
downs for our $5,000 hammer.
Yeah.
Now let me explain that. The first time we tried to simulate collecting lunar samples in the vacuum chamber pump down, we had a hammer, and they took a whack at it, and the hammer head shattered. Oh. So we had to design metal that could withstand being in a full vacuum, and one side of it being positive, 250 some odd degrees Fahrenheit, and the back side in the shadow being a minus 250. So the type of coefficient of linear expansion and contraction wouldn't be so severe that it would cause it to break. So we had to create new kinds of tools. Now, you'll like this one. We had to design a pen that would have pressure on the ink flow so we could write in zero gravity, right?
Of course.
Cost us lots of money. The Russians solved that problem much before we did.
Yes,
they used a carbon pencil.
That's right.
Yeah, at any rate, these are none of Stanley Kubrick's ideas.
All right. But that was your dad as well, wasn't it, Brett?
These are not scripted.
Okay. Let me pull up this other... Oh. You'll like these. Now, these are actual... Now, this one, I'm not sure exactly what it was used for. Well, it's a strange-looking device. You guess my business.
Okay, so it's got three upturned legs. It actually looks like something that, like a tripod upside down, but there's a kind of big metal plate in the middle.
This says some...
Sunshade. All right, so sunshade. So it's something that needs to be preserved, and there's a radiator. All right, so this is probably a sun tracking device that will tilt according to the sun. Okay, what's that? Now this looks like a massive long kind of hash pipe. No, it looks like a pipe.
Apollo 11, when Neil went out. Basically, all we expected them to do was to jump out, take this little device, a scoop, a basket, scoop a couple of rocks, jump back in, and come back to the Earth. So that's basically what the little scoop device looked like.
Apollo 17, Charlie Duke used that, and people thought it was a golf club.
That was Alan B. Shepard.
Oh, that was Shepard. Okay.
He does things like that to try to trip me up.
All right. And how could you mistake a Shepard, Brett? Please.
He took a golf ball with
Shameful.
Him. And when he whacked that ball, I guarantee you, it went further than anybody else did in the the what do you want to call the Olympic pro? Not whatever.
Oh yeah, that was definitely a record.
Yeah.
Anyway, there. So all of these different pieces of equipment were stored on the descent down in the descent stage, so that the astronauts could walk up to it. And while you talk there, I'll find a picture. Oh, this is kind of nice.
So an idea. I'm just for the audience's benefit.
I know.
Go ahead. So here's a picture of the lunar module.
On the lunar surface in the descent stage.
Oh, wait, at the what stage?
Oh, it's both the upper part, the ascent stage and the descent stage. But you can see where the doors would be on the side there to be opened. Now I'm going to pull up another picture. It'll show the door open and one of the astronauts taking out the equipment. We were just showing you some of the pictures of.
We are going to have to do this on Ever Beyond TV.
Yeah.
Come on a Monday. It's a Monday show. And we'll do an hour, and you can show us some pictures. And, brothers and sisters, this is amazing stuff. This is like the actual designs of the devices, and Ken is telling you about the materials that they had to design specially to cope with the actual surface of the moon. And there are sensors that will give you the actual surface temperature, the shade temperature, all of these things will give you the real, what about the moon rock thing?
Which one? We brought back hundreds and hundreds of pounds of lunar surface, but of rocks and things.
All right, because what's in it?
Oh,
is it homogeneous? Is it like the same or?
No, there are many different types of rocks and geology that we broke into and brought back. A lot of it had effects of meteor impacts and the force creating such heat that it melted some of the regolith, the soil, and splashed it over some other rocks that we brought back. We had crystalline type formation. Basically, almost all of the geology was similar to what you'd find on Earth. There were a few different anomalies that because of, I guess, being a part of the moon in a vacuum in space, that they were slightly different.
There were also some very rare elements, you know, aside from the ones that whole universe is made of.
So, this is like these, rhodium and, those very high numbers. And is there any like element 115? Where can I get some of that?
Like helium-3 and stuff like that?
Well,
probably.
That's
true, right?
Yes.
There's another interesting thing about the elements is that they give off a color. And so you can determine some of the moon color by looking at the elements.
I'm sure that's ringing the hollow moon. Wait. I gotta get another volume.
Now... All right, so now you brought it up. The ringing. The ringing like the bell.
Yes. Ken can describe that a lot better than I can. I'm going to make shit up because I'm an artist.
Well, and I look at things from an engineering standpoint, not a geologist either.
But he is an engineer, so he'll tell you exactly how they heard that ringing bell sound.
What mission was that, Apollo 14 or 12?
You got it, JP, that's how. The bell ringing.
Yeah,
I believe that was Apollo 11.
You think?
Yes.
What was the frequency?
It's the first time we let the lunar module come back and impact on the lunar surface. Actually, we did that on Apollo 10 as well.
Yep.
For the benefit of our listeners, Ken is now over at the desk. Bringing another folder out. This man is a one-man Google Images.
Yeah, JP.
Maybe you should have Lugal.
Literally, there's the things that are holding the images say Acme on the back of them.
Did it?
Beep, beep.
How about eventually? Hey, guys. Right? Why don't you create Lunar Google? Right? Where you can eventually put this whole thing up online.
If I knew the number,
supported by subscribers.
That would be an eventuality. Yeah.
Supported by subscribers, you could do it. Not too expensively.
Oh yeah,
but you know,
great idea. Keep talking.
Lunar Google.
See, Lugal. Isn't that cool? L-U-G-L-E. You should hang on. Let me just Google Lugal and see if it exists.
Google Lugal.
Because you know, I've just recently registered. There's so many .com names that are available. You can just say L-U-G-L-E. .com. You just, that's all you do. That's how you do it. And send a request. Oh, you could. Oh yeah. Yeah, you could buy that.
Yeah, it's available. Now I have to buy it because you looked it up.
Hang on, lugle.com.
Ken found it.
I got it. Okay, now, coming back. I'm sorry, it takes me a little time. There's thousands of pictures. This was in 1971. Okay, so that would have made it... probably Apollo 14, 15, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me bring the picture up for you. Now, what you're looking at
is a very familiar thing to me. Is a...
What happened, once we rendezvoused in lunar orbit with the upper stage of the lunar module, docked with the command module, transferred all of the equipment we needed, then we undocked and remotely fired the engines on the lunar module to make it break orbit and descend down and impact on the lunar surface. Now, people have seen earthquakes, seismology, needles shaking and moving up and down, back and forth, creating a picture graph, so to speak, of...
Yeah, it's a waveform. I would see that as a waveform, because I edit audio all the time, and other people will... and it's... Right. Hang on, let me just read this. Passive seismic experiment... And it's time and minutes, yes. And it's like it rang from 15 to 70 thereabouts. Okay.
I'm sorry. It literally rang for days. That's so. This goes to the hollow moon question. Let me get the hell right. There you go.
Yeah. Thank you. So there's the lunar impact, December the 16th, December the 10th. Right. I will see. All right, so they were just that brought. I'm not exactly sure what I saw there. Were they three separate times that those three separate waveforms were there?
Okay, if you're looking at yes, they were the initial impact. It shows it, and then the next one is December the 10th, and the bottom one is December 16th. So that's
right. So it's a low overtone.
That's right.
A very low frequency.
It's ringing like a bell.
Hang on a second. So 16th, 10th, and the impact, was that, are they 6-day intervals then?
Right.
Okay, so what we're talking about is a resonance with a 6-day wavelength.
Yep.
Which
and
is...
that's way beyond anything we've ever had on the Earth. That's why, and I think you could probably carry that on over to Mars, looking at Phobos, and the signals that the European Space Agency did when they sent the signals back through Phobos as it was going through, and basically they determined that it was virtually hollow inside, perhaps a Dyson sphere. But back on the moon, it shows that there are tremendous areas of hollowness inside, causing it to ring like a bell, as I said. And we're talking about 6 days ringing.
Yes. So, 6 day... a bell-like resonance. Now that's fascinating. That earns a
fascinating.
You see, from Spock. You see,
you weren't prepared for that one.
I've got the same jingles. It's all right. It's the same jingles every show. I've got various ones, the frequency of that low frequency implies a certain, I mean, if you actually built a spherical object, or you bought one like a Chinese bell, and you get them, a Chinese spherical bell, it would have a certain frequency to its certain size according to its thickness and the size of the hollow on the inside. So you guys are so clever, you'd have worked that out, wouldn't you? So, what data do we have about the hollowness of the chamber inside the moon?
I never thought about that in the way that you described it, but it would make perfect good sense that our geologists have been able to do the mathematics to it. I would think so. Yeah, very interesting. I like that approach.
It would also give you a determinations of the materials, because,
yes.
You know...
They do that every time they go out to drill a well, water well, or even the oil wells. They mm-hmm. they do the seismology to determine what type of strata they're going to be drilling through.
That's right. They put a thumper down, and they hear the echo back, and you can hear if it goes. It's like
you can get a really. You can also get a really good idea just based on frequency measurements, and also the inverse of the mountains and canyons.
Well, this
and
means
you can calculate things.
This means that this one picture means that that information has to be available somewhere.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
I never thought of it.
Yeah, in my guesstimation, you know, it doesn't matter if I'm wrong or not, but I have a hypothesis that it's porous like the Earth, you know, and there's cavernous bits in it, and there's lots of different cave structures and tunnels and everything else.
See, how am I supposed to know that? I'm just a pilot.
Right.
Yeah, right. So
it's all about how we schedule breakthroughs and inventions in order to do this.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Go ahead. You do it.
Exactly. I mean, you've also had to come up with a lot of new science. Like, for instance, your fabulous vacuum. See, I didn't know that. You know, I really didn't know that. That is something I had no idea. I thought, you know, if I had a piece of metal here, and it's in the air, then it's, you know, if I take it elsewhere in the universe, it's going to act the same. Are you telling me that the laws of physics are different on the moon?
This is like the nerdiest things I've ever done is talk about all this stuff.
Interesting enough. I
mean, this is scary stuff for people, you know. This is challenging to people's world view. This is not flat Earth. You know, you can't have a flat Earth mentality listening to this show, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
John Kennedy gave us a goal and a time to achieve that goal. And once we started, I actually even sat in on one meeting where Dr. Wernher von Braun was present. I can't say that I really met the man, or I did. Yeah, I shook hands with him. But anyway, we were looking at, okay, in order to accomplish the goal, we had to go in stages and phases to where because we had learned. We'd never been into space. We created the Mercury program to show that we could actually go into Earth orbit, that we could survive, and we could live under zero gravity. We went into the Gemini so we could prove that we could rendezvous and dock and do a lot of additional types of experiments. Then when we got into the Apollo phase, we were able to take all of that knowledge and everything, bring it in, but we had to do it in a staged schedule in order to meet the objective of sending man to the moon by the end of the decade, and return him safely to the Earth. We literally sat in on meetings where we'd say, well, we've got to be able to come up with a portable life support system that they can use on the surface. So we had to come up with a design and engineering, and we had to test it. One of the things that's fascinated Brett and Karen so much is that they're discovering all of the amount of work that we did in order to accomplish that, and it had to be time-phased that we literally said, okay, well, we're going to have this new invention by X period. You guys go do it. And that's why we had thousands and thousands of people all over the United States working for different companies coming up with these ideas that had to be approved. And I think one of the biggest things, what in the world would we call it? We actually had a term we used for being able to invent new equipment and material and technology to be able to accomplish it. Once you take a look and see at that, you can understand why. Now, this is what happens, though. Once you've accomplished the goal, and then the government gets involved again, and so they say, oh, it's not going to be research and development. It's going to be routine flights to the moon, so we don't need all you. Grumman laid off almost 30,000 employees for the one company alone. And so what you have is you have some of the greatest minds from von Braun and the rest of them, and I wish I had the list, that were no longer needed for research and development. And we were all laid off, and we had to find new jobs. There were more PhD scientists selling newspapers on the streets in downtown Houston than they were out in the Space Center. It was a terrible. They went on to go into private industry and improve things from solar panels to you name it, for companies that did well in with financially doing that. And though now, and I'll probably get hit for saying this, you know about the Peter principle. You get advanced to the state level of like incompetence.
A septic tank. The biggest chunks float to the top.
Yeah, there you go. Well, anyway, that is what happened a lot. And unfortunately, I mean, I had the privilege of going back to NASA after 40 years. And the comment from the press person that met us says, "Oh my God, you're Ken Johnston. You're an what's that?
An icon.
An icon." And I said, "You mean like what you move your mouse around on and make an icon out of it?" But no, he said, "You guys did things that we can't do." Interesting point for you there, TJ, is that
JP.
when George Bush Sr., whichever one it was, said that we're going to go back to the moon, NASA looked around and said, "Oh my God, we don't know how to do that now." And part of it is because whoever they are, went to a lot of us to our homes and confiscated our operations handbooks, documents, drawings, information, stuff like that, because they classified them and took them out of our hands. Those that didn't have them stashed someplace, good. And you had engineers and people from NASA going to museums, taking calipers and drawings and making pictures and drawings and calipers of equipment that we had created to go to the moon, so they could go back and try to come up with some way that we could create something to go to the moon and Mars again. So it was a fantastic accomplishment, fantastic people that drew together. We succeeded in it. And then it got pushed back into the backside. And we haven't been outside of the Earth's, orbital plane. What do you call that? Near-Earth object ourselves. We haven't gone to another planet other than remote. Non-human.
Well, you mean automated rather than non-human? Because, you know, we could send a puppy up there. Yeah. Puppies in space. You could send cats in space.
They tried that, and they killed most of them doing it.
It wasn't a good idea.
The early test animals.
Oh,
that they sent to space.
I got to meet Ham the chimp, our chimpanzee that we sent. Most people think chimpanzees are little, small, you know, pretty little thing. They grow into full size ape. Mm-hmm. And when I was going through flight school at Pensacola, they actually had the home for Ham the chimp there. I got to meet Ham. The keeper said, "You can just hold your knuckles." I think that's where knuckle bumping came from.
Well, also, you know, the astronauts themselves had a term. The pilots had a term called spam in a can, and that's probably what Ham's named after.
Oh, well, and the original joke was, "It's time to feed the monkey." But anyway, no, I got to meet Ham, and we got to bump knuckles. He says, "Don't try to shake hands, because he could literally rip your arm off out of the socket." An ape, full-size ape. So,
holy crap.
Facing things, been at their interesting places.
Indeed. I mean,
it is
very well-traveled.
Say again, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Brett. Yeah, the truth is stranger than fiction. And he's a very well-traveled simian. So let's talk about... I'm trying to balance a little bowl under the microphone so it rings and it won't, so bugger it. I'm going to just use my tuning fork. The moon ringing like a bell. Okay? All right, so let's talk about some... So what they found in the lunar surface was silicone and rare earth, you know, elements that you'd find if you had an object drifting through space over millennia, millions of years, that is accreting dust. It's, you know, right. It's going through dust, and it's going to, you know, if you push... if you push a piece of Velcro through a bunch of dust, it's going to gather it, and eventually it'll build up, and it'll be, you know, the surface will be rough, and so it'll stick more and more and more. So what have they found Do you know? I mean, this may be out of your, you know, like you said, it's geological. How far down did you go? How long were those core drills that you cored out? And what did they find in them? I'm fascinated because it shows the history of our solar system, which also shows the history of the Earth.
I'm sure you can probably find them nowadays. If you look for the Lunar Sample Information Catalogs. Now, at the Lunar Seeding Laboratory, I had a typing pool, and we would take the geologists' initial analysis of the samples before they were sent out to scientists around the world that would test them in their own laboratories. We would produce what was called the Lunar Sample Information Catalog, and it would answer all of those questions right down to the element that you're looking for. But unfortunately, I can't tell you myself because I was in charge, okay? I didn't have to do it and know it.
I've got some of those answers. There was a retired senior scientist from NASA that has come out and said that some of the things that were typed out weren't exactly true, because he knows, because he's the one that typed them out a long time ago. And he came out finally and said that inside those samples, meteorites and such, and also from the moon and Mars, were bits of bacteria and different particles, and also evidence of water and nitrogen. So this guy comes out and basically he's just saying, look, I'm the one that actually analyzed those things, and I can tell you that there is life out in space.
That's news to me, sitting right beside the guy.
So, you know, that's one of the things. His name was Hoover, I believe. Dr. Hoover. You can find him on YouTube or something like that, and he's given some interviews to people. But you can also find some of this information in KenJohnstonMedia.com, and there inside the mission reports is included the lunar sample
Initial report.
So there you go. That's how you find out about these things. All right. So now, the moon. I've often described the behavior of the moon to people who I've trapped at a party in a corner, right? I give them this little mental exercise. Imagine you had a nice, big, fat, powerful magnet standing on a table, sitting on a table. And you also had a little helium balloon, or a large helium balloon, and you stuck a very small magnet to that helium balloon. The balloon would float, and it would be subtly drawn towards the magnet. It wouldn't be, you know, sucked down to it, but it would kind of align itself, wouldn't it? And then as you walk around the table with the balloon, that magnet will continue to face the balloon. Will continue to face the magnet as it goes around the table. You understand? That is the behavior of the moon. Tell me what you know about that.
One of the interesting things that we first discovered when we actually sent our first probes and satellites to the moon is that when we would calculate how much time it would take to make one orbit and come from the backside back around the front, that it should be at a certain location and direction back to the Earth. And there was a deviation that we found out. And we eventually started calling these magnetic anomalies on the lunar surface. There were, because of the elements inside the moon and the amount of metal that it contained, it created a difference. It's not a fixed amount of gravitational pull towards the Earth. And I'm not an astrophysicist or whatever, but I would say that the moon itself, the area facing towards the Earth, would be very much like your magnet on your balloon. That part has stabilized so that as you walk around, or in this case the moon goes around the Earth, it pulls and holds that side of the moon facing the Earth all the time. In the third grade, I had a teacher trying to tell us that the moon did not rotate, that and then, you know, those things. And I actually got a basketball and a light and had it shine on it to show her that the backside of the moon wasn't dark all the time, that as it moved between the Earth and the sun was shining on the backside of the moon. and this was in the third grade, and I hope the teacher learned that lesson.
Absolutely, and there is a complexity to that because the moon has somewhat of a wobble.
Yes, it does.
You know, so it doesn't it isn't perfectly faced toward the Earth all the time. It sort of does a little wibble thing dance. As it goes around.
It's a little bit of a dance.
Yeah,
it's like what's that crater that's facing almost in the middle? I got to remember that was we found that there were buttresses in that crater that looked like it had had a dome over it one time, and slightly below
Ukert.
To the left.
Huh? Ukert or Ukert?
No, yeah, Ukert. Yeah. And if you're tracking its position facing the Earth, you can see the wobble or the dance around that as the moon wobbles as it goes around.
Well, there you go. That would also account for, say, there were maybe multiple magnets on our balloon.
Okay.
And as we walked around, different aspects would be pulled in, you know, as the Earth rotated, which also has probably magnetic anomalies in it, like big, fat iron deposits on the rifts, for instance.
And the Earth itself also has that, and that could account for the difference between the apogee and perigee of the moon's distance from the Earth. And it, you know, certain angles, and because of the whole solar system, you've got the magnetic pull of the various planets as well as the sun, and so that pulls on the moon, and so it'll drift out further out and then gets away, and then it'll come back in a little bit closer. So it's not a perfectly round,
It's an elliptical orbit, and you know that's why you look at the moon, and sometimes people accuse the moon of changing or something, and that would account for that. Also, that the man on the moon may be sitting or standing.
Sitting with what?
He may be sitting or standing.
Okay. Okay.
So, oh God. Hey, we need to take a break. I need to go and stack wood in my fire and get it going again because it's getting cold in here now. I want to prime you with a question that you can answer after the break. Now, first of all, this is from Dolly, right? And she's saying, how the hell can you say all this stuff and not be like shot in the head by some black agent in the middle of the night? All right. So we're gonna leave that till after the break.
Yep.
Now let's just see. What shall we have? Where should we go? Have I got any moon music? I've got loads of moon music. Oh, come on. Think of something moon music. I bet I haven't got any. Well, I mean, there's anything from Dark Side of the Moon, isn't there?
Yeah, there's.
There you go.
You know, there's. What do you call it?
Song. Music.
Yeah, let's see, I forgot his name.
What is that?
This is fun.
Oh, there's a song. Yeah, there's a song called Talking to the Moon.
All right. Talking to the Moon. No, but anyway, I haven't got that, but I have got, let's do...
Stick with rock, yeah. That's
yeah,
cool.
Let's do, what did you say? Well, there's, here's the thing, one's called Brain Damage, and the last one is called Eclipse. Okay. These are the last two tracks on Dark Side of the Moon, and they're quite short. So, here we go. You haven't heard this for a while, guys. Brain Damage.
Looking forward to it.
You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. You are listening to Wolf Spirit Radio, and welcome back to the second hour of Ever Beyond tonight. Tonight with Brett Shepherd in the control seat and operating the massive Lugal archive. Remember where you heard it first. Massive Lugal archive is Dr. Ken Johnston, ex-ob NASA, but he kept the photos. Haha, smart man. So, meanwhile, so here's the thing. Here's the thing, you know, Dolly's going mad. She's very worried for you. She's what was the last thing? She's got such a vivid imagination. Check this. Hang on, where are we? First of all, JP, are the guys going to get into trouble for sharing so much info with us? I'm thinking the guys are going to be suicided tonight. Maybe hang themselves and then shoot themselves in the head and jump out the window. She's very concerned, is Dolly. Bless your heart.
Well, I really appreciate the warm thoughts of protection. And I think timing is very important in just about everything we do. And I'll say this, it was 1995 in Seattle, Washington. And mind you, my kids had grown up looking at a few pictures and things. And I basically had kept, I had a personal safe that was, good grief, there was a 5,000 pound safe that I got that I kept everything in. And other times I kept them in vaults at banks. But anyway, with the Grumman Corporation, excuse me, not Grumman, Boeing, I was a flight instructor on 737 aircraft. And within Boeing, there was a group of us that were interested in UFOs, ETs, space, you name it. We formed our own little group. We called it Come on, help me out here, Brett.
Majestic
12, excuse me.
MJ-12, the mysterious.
Yes, and we...
MJ-12.
We didn't have emails and cell phones and goodies and things like that. We just had the inter-office mail, and we would send... We heard something or saw something on the news or whatever. We'd make copies of it, and we'd send it to each other. Anyway, so we all knew what each other's interests were, and I had gotten a book on the... that was written by Mr. Richard C. Hoagland, and in it he had asked, you know, anybody who had records and material and pictures and things from back in the space program that needed to come forward and make that information available. So, and I love getting authors' signatures on books. So I was off that one evening. He was having a conference, and one of my friends said, "Oh, Mr. Hoagland's going to be here doing a conference. You ought to go down and meet him in person." So I put together a little letter of introduction and went down to the conference center, walked in, and I walked up to the desk to pay my fee to go to the conference. And I handed the young lady there the letter. I said, Mr. Hoagland would like to see the letter. And she's reading it, and her eyes get big. She looked at me. She says, "Don't move. Stay right where you are." And I'm getting a little worried, like, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. And a couple of minutes later, Mr. Hoagland comes out in the back, and he looked at my letter. He asked me a couple of questions. I told him what I had been doing in the space program and what I had as an archive. He took me and set me on the front row, and they made agreements to come over the next morning with a team of six of them, and they took a good look at what I had archived and kept. And he said, "We need to be sure that we make you so publicly known that they wouldn't dare do some things, whereas certain people have disappeared. They died of sudden kind of cancer that's eaten them alive in a matter of weeks." And so the key to answer the lady's question, am I concerned? I would have been, except that to the point now that if anything happens to me, there'll be so much, so many questions asked, and that they would be put to the task to explain what happened. So I actually feel like I'm being protected now instead of running the risk of being exterminated.
Stand well out in the open.
Well, there's that. There's also the aspect of the soft disclosure issue that they have nowadays, because many of the black ops guys and people behind the scenes from the Department of Defense and all, their job, their contingent in the beginning was to make sure that there was continuity of government and that nobody was going to threaten the financial system or religious system and all that. And now the world is quite different, because the financial system is sort of crashing. They're having issues with some of these things, and they need to restore some faith back in to some of the agencies of government. And with that contingent, they've set out to put basically disinfo agents out, and also debunkers. Their sole job is to get people to ask the question, are there UFOs and aliens? Not really to debunk the people that say there are.
What they were doing in the original is they would embarrass people so much if they were to come forward. Pilots knew better than to even mention anything. Actually, recently Buzz Aldrin, the number two man to step foot on the moon in Apollo 11, came out and says on their translunar insertion, while they were in coasting between the Earth and the Moon, there was a lit object, some object that got fairly close that they were watching, that was tracking and following them the whole mission. And they knew they couldn't come right out and tell Mission Control that, hey, we have a UFO out here following us. They came up with the idea and asked where were the S4B stage of the Saturn that put them into Translunar Coast, where it was located, and it was thousands of miles away, and you'd have never been able to see it. So now Buzz Aldrin comes out and says, so in reality, this object thing followed them all the way to the moon. And he says, and what else can you call it other than an unidentified flying object? So that's a pretty powerful statement coming from an astronaut.
And hence the mysterious quote, Santa Claus does exist. Isn't that true?
I've heard that, of course. I know on Apollo 4, when we went to the moon and looped around the moon with astronaut Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Anders, on the way coming back, it was during December the 25th, 1968, I think it was, and they made the comment, Santa Claus, there is a Santa Claus, and they were tracking, but then again, this was all having to do with the holidays. We think, now, I don't know, there are keywords we always use, what is it, when we have a bogey.
Yeah, you'd say bogey, or on the moon, they used to say, yes, I see the big mountain.
There you go. So we had to have...
The big mountain. And that's a disc, or is that a kind of little horde of ETs kind of all skimpering towards you?
It's so exciting for me to actually be a part of what's happening right now, and that Brett so eloquently put it, is soft disclosure. And I put the call out every time to other people. Now, mind you, I was the youngest of all of the test subjects and test pilots, if you will, what do they call us? Civilian astronaut consultant pilots. That's what they call us. Anyway, so many of the people that I knew back then, these were senior engineers and scientists, they've already passed away. They're gone. And with them, they've taken the knowledge and information that they had. So we're saying, if you have anything to do, or you have records, or you have information, you need to come forward right now and get it out there, or else when you die or you're gone, that information is going to be lost from history. And we really need that as a species to know what our history is.
I think so. precursor to... There's a lot of things that were secret that really need to be known, and some people who, under threat of their lives...
Right.
And their children's lives and their dogs and, other parts of the, world, were sworn to secrecy about some things.
We all had to sign that.
Exactly. Now, here's the thing. This also goes back to I'm going to bring him in. Okay. The Nazi Bell experiments and all of that kind of thing. The very secret things that only the survivor who wrote his memoirs, who gave them to a journalist, who gave them to a book writer, who eventually published them, would we ever know about this project. And it's fascinating. It's really fascinating, because it shows you all of the ways that the Nazis were creating the same situation that we have with these secret... societies and things like that, the compartmentalization, the way that information flows and all that, it was exactly the same. And that's also confirmed by Simon Parks.
And as I've heard, if they had been able to maintain for another 6 months, we would all be speaking German today.
That's right, because, I'm not kidding about this. This experiment was sci-fi, because they created a teleport machine that could literally teleport an atomic weapon to Washington with no warning. Boom.
Well,
it had something to do with the Philadelphia experiments and the Manhattan projects and all that.
Yeah. And according to this book, we weren't 6 months away. We were 1 month away from Glocka being deployed. Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as food goes, I wouldn't have minded really.
Okay.
Well, it could have been a blessing.
It's Berliner, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, Neu-Berlin, yeah. Neu-Berlin. It's not New York anymore. It's Neu-Berlin, yeah. So...
And I live in a little town called Berlin.
Exactly. You know, well, here we go. Meanwhile, okay, so... Dolly's jumping up and down. Jumping up and down. You know you shouldn't do that.
Keep you off balance.
Poor Dolly. She's got all these questions, you see. She's got... Dolly talks to all kinds of beings and is just brilliant. So she's saying, what did you find on the other side of the moon?
Oh.
Did you actually find the famed swastika shaped building? did you find a great big hole? Is there a great big kind of concave surface? Is the moon the Death Star? We have questions, Ken. We have questions.
Okay. All right. Now, because of my prior military experience and knowledge with cameras and gun sequence cameras, and I describe it for people that anytime you've seen a newsreel and it shows an aircraft chasing another one and you see the projectiles or bullets going out, and those are the cameras so that when they get back, they can analyze what took place and they can get a good look. Well, in my position as the director of the Data and Photo Control Department at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, I was in direct contact with all of the various engineers, scientists, and directors of different branches at NASA. And by the way, the debunker that's out there that's been going after me, I posted on my Facebook page pictures where they can go and look at when I left NASA, left the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, there's like 76 different scientists and engineers that wished me well and signed this big picture of the moon rock, and the astronauts there are, gosh, I don't, 22 different astronauts that signed a big picture for me, thanking me for what I did. You know, they can try to rub me out of history, but I'm there. Okay, now back to your question was on the help me out here.
The dark side of the moon. No, there is no dark side of the moon, Matt. You see, I don't know if you...
What I discovered on the back side of the moon. That's what you want to know.
What did you find on the dark... On the let's say, it's not the back side of... you can say it's the back. It's the far side of the moon. The side that is always on the other side of the balloon from the magnet.
There you go.
Okay, so everybody get this clear in their mind. We see the same face. This is the one of the lunar anomalies, you know, one of them.
And I like your balloon example about explaining why it stays facing the same direction all the time.
You may use it with my permission.
Just off outside of the NASA Johnson Space Center, there was a gorgeous, gorgeous mansion called the Jim West Mansion, and it had been acquired by NASA, and it became the Lunar and Planetary Science building, and it's outside the main structures of the Johnson Space Center. And the director of the Lunar and Planetary Science and the scientist was Dr. Thornton Page, that you can look up. And he called me in my office and he said, "Kim, would you go to the photo lab and check out Apollo 14 film, such number, and set up a showing for myself and some of our other scientists?" And he says, "And get one of those good projectors that can project gun sequence." So I the next day I went to the lab, checked out the film, went over next the building next door to Mission Control, first floor in the main conference room, and I set up the camera, and we're showing the pictures, and the guys are sitting back there, and there's six scientists and then Dr. Page, and they're watching the film, and we're coming around on the back side of the moon, and we're approaching a crater identified as Tsiolkovsky. And remember, the Russians, they gave names to all of them, basic craters that were at least 100 kilometers. This one, Tsiolkovsky, is about 125 kilometers wide. Anyway, this was during the lunar phase when the sun was about a half moon looking from the Earth at night. Well, half of it was in light on the backside as well. So this crater, half of the bottom of the crater was in shadow. So I'm clicking along, and as we're coming up on the crater, looking in the shadow area, there were, if you'll take your hand, turn your hand palm up, bring all of your fingers together, forming a little lump of like five little bubbles there. that's what we were looking at in the crater, on that side of it. And they looked like they were illuminated from the inside, and one of them had a stream or something projecting up steam or column of smoke, something. And Dr. Page had me freeze the camera, back up, approach it a couple more times, zoom in close, back up, go back and come in two or three frames at a time, click, 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 taking a look at it. And finally, he had me stop, and he turned to the other six guys and says, "Well, boys, what do you think of that?" And they all gave a big chuckle and a laugh. And you got to keep in mind that we were moving so fast that by the time we say, "Oh, wow, I want to look at this. I want to check this out later." But then a contract would end, we'd get moved or what have you. And then the program is, "Oh, we never got a chance to go back and check them." But I was scheduled to take that same reel the next day to the main auditorium at Johnson Space Center. And then during lunch, play that film so that the rank and file engineers and janitors and everybody else would have a chance to see what we saw. And I was really excited about it. Dr. Page told me to finish up showing the rest of that reel and then put it back. They're all over there talking, and I'm taking the reel, packing it up, putting it inside the canister, and then they left, I left, went to the photo department, checked it back in. As I'm walking into the photo lab, there's three phases and three areas within the photo lab. One of them is outside where people can come in and they can request a picture, etc. And you don't have to have any kind of clearance at all. Just go in the front. You go into the middle room, and that's where, if you're cleared, you can check out things and you can set up tables and you can review them and look at them, do what you want to there. And in that room, there was a table called a light table, probably 3 foot by 4 foot with light underneath, opaque. And sitting at the table, there were three people, two men and one young lady. And they were leaning over looking at negatives, and we didn't have Photoshop in those days. They were taking pens and they were painting out things on the surface and on the horizon and all. And it was shocking to me because I'm carrying a canister of film. And I said, "What are you guys doing?" One of the guys quipped very quickly. He says, "Oh, we're professional strippers." The young lady jokingly requested, she said, "No, what we're doing is, we call it stripping. We are painting out objects and things on the horizon and sky because we don't want to confuse people with stars and lights and things like that. And so we're just painting those out." I said, "Oh." Well, I went into the back for the third room, and there you have to have it above a secret, at least a secret clearance or above, to go inside where all of the films and pictures are kept. And I checked that back in. Now, the next day, 24 hours later, I checked out the same reel number, took it to the main auditorium. I set it up and started showing it. I had my brother, Dr. A.R. Johnston, there, and a good friend, and we were watching the film, and I'm telling you guys, are not going to believe what we found on the backside of the moon. And I was waiting to surprise them. And we approached Tsiolkovsky, and there was nothing there. It was black. I mean, it was the shadow. It was gone. I stopped the camera. I told the audience, I said, "A moment, I'm having technical difficulties. One moment, please." I took the film out, and I checked the holes, the everything. Didn't show that it had been cut or spliced. So, in reality, within 24 hours, they had to have taken the same reel that I had, made a duplicate of it, taken out the portion, painted them out, put them back in, and then dubbed a copy so that I had a complete copy to be able to show to the audience. Anyway, and I put the film back in and finished it up. When I went back to check that reel back into the photo lab, going back over to the lunar receiving lab, I ran into Dr. Page. And he's walking along, and I said, "Dr. Page, what happened to the stuff we saw on the backside of the moon in that crater?" He looked at me and closed his eye and winked at me. And now, mind you, those people are going to say, "Dr. Page wore a patch over one eye and over his left eye." And so how could he wink? I said, "Well, you put your hand over your eye, and you do a wink, and you keep it closed for a second, bring it back home. You know they're winking at you." And he said, "There was never anything there." And so I was determined I was going to maybe get a chance to look at it. But then we had a reduction in force at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory because we were approaching the end of the lunar missions. And that was about it. I next thing you know, I left space program for about 3 years and then applied for the astronaut program again and had letters of recommendation from the guys and went back to work with TRW at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory and then on and on. The history goes on. It's all in my books. Just go to kenjohnstonmedia.com and you can find it all in there. But though that's what we found on the backside of the moon. And it wasn't until just recently, and I've got to look at Brett and say, my God, where do you come up with your eyes? But artists look at things with a different part of their brain than engineers do. He found one of my pictures, one of the slides of Tsiolkovsky, and they're in the shadowed area of the same picture I have. He was able to look through some of the painting enough in depth to bring up showing a glow of light inside that shaded area of Tsiolkovsky. So he has found proof that what I said is there.
Ah, nobody expected Photoshop.
Fantastic.
Yeah, the other thing I'd like to mention is when Dr. Thornton Page is mentioned, a lot of people don't know who that is. He was on the Robertson panel with Carl Sagan, and their main job was to debunk UFOs and aliens. So, you know, they were specifically focused on military personnel that would accidentally see something, should I say.
CIA. CIA.
So, yes.
Yeah, easy. So, so he was your infiltrator man, and you know, he's always portrayed. You know, they portray him in the X-Files and shows like that, don't they? There's always this kind of he's the insider who
controls
everything.
Yes, I also during that time when Ken actually saw what he saw. There was James Oberg, who was taken under the wing of Dr. Thornton Page, and he has ever since been quite the debunker for NASA.
He's a very good friend of mine.
And once he was a very good friend of Ken's, and now he doesn't even admit that they had a relationship at all. So
I think his memory is slipping. Yeah. He accuses me of embellishing things in my memory, but my eye memory is easy to keep up because I have documents and pictures and records and everything else to keep that very positive in my memory. Like, if you look at the World Trade Center being attacked and crumbling, you know exactly where you were at that moment when that happened. Or when Neil Armstrong first stepped on the moon, you know exactly what you were doing. The same thing with the archive and stuff. I look at those things, and bingo, I mean, they have a lot of fun with me when we're putting together these books because they'll ask a question, and then all of a sudden I'll come spewing out a whole bunch of information that I haven't thought about in years.
Exactly. So it triggers a vast amount of knowledge in you. See,
you know, things were very compartmentalized back during the Apollo days, and James Oberg could not have possibly experienced the same thing Ken has, or Donna Hare, or anyone that worked for NASA. You know, they all had their own special experience with that time period and with the Apollo program. So there, when he comes out and claims that there's no way that Ken could have seen something like that, or there's no way, well, James Oberg does not know that. He asked me earlier today, you know, why should people believe Ken? And I can tell you that Ken has never lied to me, and he has never lied about his experiences working with the Apollo program.
And I have the records to prove it.
So here's the thing, right? We're Wolf Spirit Radio. We have excellent discernment.
Yeah.
Okay. We know, we can hear when people are giving us B, and we, you know, and I can see, and we can hear, and, you know, this gentleman is, as they say, the real deal. He knows his stuff. He actually, Ken, you probably know more than anybody about anything, because you're the youngest survivor. You were the youngest then. You're now our elder, right? And really, you should be doing seminars. Really?
I would like to acknowledge a pattern. Most of the elder astronauts, you know, they were heroes. They went on suicide missions, and all of them, in their later years before they had passed. There's just a handful alive now that are in their 80s. And before they all had passed, they all admitted that they saw something unusual. Mm. Well, either on the moon or on the way to the moon or whatnot. Even back during the Mercury days, John Glenn saw his fireflies, and they downplayed that as something that flitted off of the spaceship, you know.
Do you know, if you're in your kitchen, it's really hard to keep life out of things. I've always found, you know, it's the slightest excuse and something will start growing there. Therefore, in my opinion, the universe is teeming with life. Absolutely teeming with life. And space, because we're looking at something on a micro scale compared with a very, very macro scale, we may find that space is more like a sea than something else. It has a different consistency to what we think is this empty stuff, this empty, weightless, you know, somehow beingness that space seems to be. There's got to be a reality. I mean, we now, you know, we're aware now of the Van Allen belts, you know, and I've heard stories about the astronauts seeing these little sparkles that even when their eyes are closed, boom, 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 they're pinging their eyes. This is the experience. How, you know, is there anybody who's been through the Van Allen belt that you know, in your experience, who has been through multiple times and, as you know, as people would be worried about, did they die early, basically?
Well, we get the people coming, all like, there's no way you could have gone to the moon because you would have died going through the Van Allen belt. Well, the answer is, we didn't go and sit in the Van Allen belt until we absorbed so much radiation that we died. We went through it like a bullet at high speed, and the amount of radiation that you would get going through the Van Allen belt going to the moon, it was equivalent to about getting your teeth x-rayed by the dentist. So when you look at it from that standpoint...
Yeah, they were going through that like a you know, 1,000 miles per hour or something, you know?
Over 17,000.
17,000. So, yeah, it wasn't a Sunday drive through the Van Allen belt.
No. Now, we talked about, you know, that we're getting people to come forward now and get information out that they may have been keeping all of these years. Well, there's now that we're approaching what's called soft disclosure, but an organization called We Are Disclosure. Those of us who have experienced all these things, we are the ones that are coming out and coming forward with it. And this coming October here in Albuquerque, there is the WeAreDisclosure.com. If you go to WeAreDisclosure.com, and these are for people that are going to be able to come out and say for sure what they had experienced, either ET pictures or what have you. And book number 5, they've already pushed me up to that point. There are things that have happened into not just myself, but other people's lives that you look back and say, well, now how did that happen? Because that put me on this course that made me be at this place, that event in time. Kind of like they coined the phrase, I think that Alan Shepard did in his book called The Right Stuff. Well, jokingly, they say, how did you wind up to be at the right place at the right time with the right stuff to do the right thing and save the pictures and have it available for the rest of the world? Now, I don't have an answer to that, but I know that Dr. Sasha Lesson and them are experts in hypnotherapy, and even I was an expert hypnotist back in my younger years in college. But I can't come out and directly say absolutely positive that some of the things that I've seen are real until I have Dr. Lesson hypnotize me and we'll do some regression and do some research. We're going to do that next week at the UFO Congress that's going to be happening in Scottsdale, Arizona. And there's going to be people from all over the world coming forward and talking about contacts that they've had and what took place. So there is a lot going on in this world right now, and it's about time.
Absolutely. This is something, well, I am slightly emotionally overwhelmed. I'm not kidding, because this is like something we've all been waiting for. Ever since I was a child, I knew that, it's just a joyful thing. It's just so joyful. It's like finally being listened to when nobody's listened to you all your life.
Yeah. You transmitted that energy shock. I'm getting the tingling thing to actually feel that I'm actually being a part of this. And even though a small part it may be, I'm excited that I'm having the opportunity to experience this.
We're making history.
Well, yes, we are.
Well, so there we are. We've got more people. Are you? So you've got some databases. You've got some websites. You're having meetings.
Yeah.
You're creating networks. Do you have a private social network that you can connect yourselves with? Are you considering using something like Scene, scene.is or something like in Iceland?
Well, you know, Ken likes to look at his email, so he's got kenjohnstonsenior@gmail.com.
That's the email address I use for all of this stuff that's coming out in the books and things, yes.
Yeah.
I try to answer all the questions I get.
And he's also on Facebook, you know, and so am I, C. Shepherd, Brett Colin Shepherd on Facebook, and they can also look at my Lunar Anomaly Research Society on Facebook. And that's a wonderful group to go into. There's a lot of information there that is alternative. Some of it I really don't approve of. I do get the flat earthers and the we didn't go to the moon guys, and they get kicked out of my group, you know. So I don't believe in that.
Good. So, you know, this is just marvelous stuff. So, listen, Ken.
Okay.
Please.
I'm listening.
Can we linger over that moment when you first roll, when the guy, was it you who did it, or you were watching this guy do it? You were operating the camera. Rolling the pictures one by one, and suddenly you saw this bubble thing. Can you describe what you saw for the record? Just in as great a detail as you can. I mean, you saw, what, you know, the first picture, you saw something, a blue, a color?
Okay. Let me say this, that since then, and mind you, when these things were put behind and you're raising a family and you got 18 grandkids and 2 great-grandchildren and a great-great one coming up, anyway, you don't necessarily focus on this day in and day out, and then it wasn't until after 1995, 96, when I started going back and looking at this material and then looking at the data and started to thinking about it. And I realized that now that when, excuse me, Dr. Page asked me to go and check out this particular reel, they knew what was going to be on that reel to start with, and that's why he had the other scientists there to experience it. And I, at the time, I had a top secret clearance, so I was cleared to be the one to set it up and show it to him. And I never thought about it in that aspect, in that respect, until very recently, since I've been working with Rich Shepherd and Karen here. So when I was showing the film, and I had no idea what was coming up, and we're going along on a nice slow speed, not too fast, kind of like slow motion, as we're coming up on the backside, and as we're approaching this medium-sized crater about 25 kilometers across, and in the shadow, because it was the half-moon phase on both front and backside, in the shadowed area was a cluster of 5 domes. And as I try to describe, the best way I've described this to other people is to take your hand and turn it palm up, and then fold each one of your fingers in till they're all touching each other, and looking at the top of them straight down, they all make 5 little bubbles. Well, that's what we were looking at inside the crater in the dark area. And one of them, probably closest to the rim of the crater, was a column or a steam or something that was being projected out of the top. And it was like a shock, unbelievable, of what we were looking at. I was realizing that I was looking at something that no one else in the world had ever seen. And then I knew that Dr. Page had told me that the next day I would be showing the same reel to the rank and file at NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston. And so I had to keep the secret until the next day. And I'm so excited about it. I didn't even tell my brother what it was we were going to see, and my good friend. And it was such a shock the next day when I'm showing the film in the main auditorium, when we come up to that same crater and the same event, that it was gone. And I, you know, you're right. It was a, an event that happened in my life that I could not fathom. And that's why when I asked Dr. Page, you know, what happened to it, and he came right out and winked and said there was never anything there. I didn't understand all of that. I had a job to do at the Literacy Laboratory. We all had our functions. We just kept doing our jobs, and then we were let loose and sent on our way and thanked, but then without the opportunity to go back and research and look for that particular real field somewhere in an archive, in a sealed vault with the proper amount of hydrogen, oxygen, or whatever it is to help preserve them. These reels and these pictures and these negatives in their original form are there. And I think Brett does a better job in describing why the soft disclosure, and it's not condemning NASA or them for what was taking place, but understanding why it was being done, and those of us that were being manipulated or used have kept our mouths shut for so long, and now we realize that the only safety we have is in numbers and coming forward.
Absolutely. So, Ken?
Yes.
Okay, so I just want to take you breath.
Right.
If you wouldn't mind, just taking a breath, right? Because... Because this is an historic moment. And I want to kind of record this in as many sensory... give as much sensory data into this remote viewing of this very, very secret and somehow sacred moment. And if you could... Just tell me, how did you feel the first time you saw that doesn't belong there?
It was proof. It was proof. We are not alone.
That was your first feeling?
Absolutely. I was excited.
You were excited, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. Just bouncing off the walls. I could not wait till the next day when I could show everybody else. Because here I was in this very... very unique group of eight people, Dr. Page, six other scientists, and myself. That's it. Wow. It was a moment that I was just overwhelmed with the fact and just giddy almost, bounced off the walls when I went back to work. Just, I couldn't work. I was just sitting around like, oh my God, what do you see? They're there. They're there. Whoever they are.
Whoever they are, or whoever we are, you never know.
Yeah, we are they. We are them.
Exactly.
Yeah, I see, and when I'm looking at all these images, I see a very eclectic group of structures or whatnot. I see both new and ruins. I see old, ancient things, too.
So that was just the beginning of it, and then now we have experts in art and science that are looking at my archive, my collection, and looking at things and discovering things. That's why one of the things that Brett and us are not doing is we're not trying to corner the market and saying, my God, look at this picture, look at this. How about AS1588-11970? That picture there will literally knock your socks off. And I've had it in my archive for 45 years, and I never noticed it, but Brett sure did. But what I'm publishing is going to be the raw, I mean, best pictures, highest DPI we could scan them at, and the more data is there actually in the DPI.
Yeah, I will do the best I can to get those in archived in a book for everybody at the highest resolution as I possibly can. There's well over 500 pictures, you know, in the book. And they are all the actual picture images with the image numbers on them, and they're the real deal.
But we want people to be able to go and discover these things themselves.
Yeah,
not that we're going to corner the market at all. In fact, that
my intention at all. I'm very good at anomaly hunting. I can go there and cherry pick every single image there is. But there's literally hundreds of thousands of things that people can discover in these images. And one way I would describe, you know, things to people, you can go to the site kenjohnstonmedia.com and get the lunar anomalies that we're talking about in a free PDF.
It's about 16 pages there, yeah. and showing some of just a few of the anomalies that we've seen, and then giving kind of an open idea of, yeah. of the quality of pictures and things that you're going to be looking at.
Another way to look at it, or whatever, when you're looking at an overhead view of the lunar surface, think similar to high altitude imagery of the Earth, you know, and how archaeologists take overhead shots of maybe, you know, Adam's calendar or some ruins or something, you know. So that is a good way to look at the surface of the moon, and also consider the aspects of initially when the images were taken, they were sort of washed out, some of them, and some are very old, you know. But I've corrected some of them the best I could without tampering with them.
That's great. What's the kind of revolution? What's the sort of resolution you have in today's terms?
4 months.
Very quickly. The images were originally put out at a little over 11,000 DPI, and since then NASA has put them out at 4,000, so they've already lowered the resolution by half. Ken's images are very, very high resolution, and I will try to keep them as high as I can.
Okay. And we're going to have to sign off here very quickly there.
Yeah.
JP.
Yeah, we're about out of here.
Well, look, thank you so much. I feel, actually, that this has been an historic moment. I only wish I could say things better. Ken Johnston, Dr. Ken Johnston, thank you so much. It's been an honor, a delight, and a pleasure. How can I be more excited? I feel that energy that you describe. And actually, we're getting feedback from the chat room. We're all feeling that
great
excitement. Thank you for sharing that with us, sir.
Just have them go to kenjohnstonmedia.com, and you can follow the rest of us, because we're launching on a great, exciting opportunity for all mankind.
Yeah, thank you, everyone, for preserving history with us.
Excellent. And where are you going now? If anybody wants to continue your journey, because you'll be talking about other stuff.
Yes, we are going to aquarianradio.com, and we will be on there for the next couple of hours.
Awesome, awesome. Fantastic. Thank you so much. Good night, guys.
Thanks for having me on. Goodbye.
Beyond.